Accession number 27185, Real 10.
Major Barras, Real 10. Did the battalion remain in Leinster?
Yes, it remained there until February. But during that time, I perhaps should say that some of the wives were allowed to come up and stay with their husbands for, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks. But of course, a lot of officers weren't married in those days because, first of all, you weren't permitted to get married until you were 30. Then you had to get your CO's permission. And I remember there was one chap called Johnny Haythornthwaite, who was a lieutenant, who actually went ahead and got married. And he was referred to by what is living in sin. But of course the marriage, the limits were reduced to 26, I think, later on. There's one thing just occurred to me that I didn't mention earlier in my letters during the time of the possible invasion. Looking at my letters, I don't seem to refer to the invasion at all, or the possibility of the Germans coming. There was one PS I noticed where I said, rather jokingly, that if they landed on Southend Pier, I hope they'd have to pay their entrance fee. But apart from that, there's no mention at all.
Do you think you were being secure and being discreet in?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we were all talking about it. It just didn't occur to me as a subject to write home about.
Taken for granted, then?
Well, I suppose the whole situation was taken for granted, yeah. I did mention that, hoping that they weren't being bombed too much and that sort of thing. And the other day, listening to the radio and hearing about some of the IRA activities, or the real IRA activities, I sometimes wonder whether most of the IRA as we know it all haven't moved out and gone to the real IRA. But it occurred to me that I didn't mention before the war, in 1939, sometime during that summer, I was sent off down to Woolwich with my platoon to Mount Guards because of a threat from the IRA. There were more patrols than guards, and I remember I was billeted in a hotel there. I can't remember how long it was, but you know, it goes to prove that the IRA is nothing new.
Do you remember what you were told about the level of threat or the type of threat?
Remember, no. I know we used to hear now and again of sort of bombs being placed near police stations in Ireland, but Northern Ireland, but nobody took much notice of it in those days.
Do you remember if you were given any sort of list of people you were supposed to look out for, or
no,
anything like that?
No, of course, that was the original IRA, not the present one, which is called, what do they call themselves? Provisional IRA. No, it wasn't the provisionals in those days, it was the old IRA.
Did you have any sort of suspicious incidents while you were
preparing? No, none at all, none. I used to sort of walk around hoping that I would catch somebody with a bomb in their hand, but I never did.
When you were doing this patrolling, do you remember what strength you were in when you went out?
Well, I didn't actually physically myself do the patrolling. I mean, I organised the soldiers going out to be a corporal and two or three men, probably. I can't remember how many we mounted at a time. But, of course, Woolwich Arsenal in those days was a very huge place. So I imagine that our activities were confined to the most important part of the, or the most vulnerable part of the whole place, which could have been of interest to anybody wanting to sabotage. But nothing happened, so I went back to the battalion.
Do you have any idea of why you were sent out at that particular time?
Well, I suppose there must have been a threat of some sort. I mean, the same as today. People get intelligence, they get information that something is brewing. Fortunately, nothing did on the mainland at that time. But it was still going on in Northern Ireland, but not as drastically as it was after Motorman, I think it was, when we sent the troops there. I knew they wouldn't get out again the time when they went in.
So you were saying that you were at Leinster for the winter.
Yes.
And,
well, I had some leave there, I remember, because I've just read a letter saying that going back in my train, we got outside London and the train stopped altogether and there was a raid on. And then from then onwards, the train crawled along, because in those days with steam engines, with sparks coming out of the chimneys, it wasn't a good idea, so they had to go very slowly. And I did say I was arrived an hour and a half late at my destination, which was quite common in those days. And the trains were crowded, absolutely crowded with soldiers and airmen and sailors and everybody. So it wasn't a lot of fun travelling by train anymore than it is today. The other thing which I didn't point out when we were at, in Leinster, was we had to go out to the to Wales, so the big reservoirs out there, Raid, I think it was called, to have a look to see what we would do if the Germans ever dropped parachutists to try and take control of the control tower there, because the water there was the main supply for Birmingham. I think the Welsh were rather reluctant to give their rain to people in Birmingham, but I know we did a recce out there to see what we would do if there was a threat.
What was it thought the Germans might try to do?
They sabotage the control tower there, which would stop water from flowing to Birmingham, just dry it out altogether, I suppose. But nothing ever happened. But we were warned to be ready to go.
Was this when you were intelligence officer that you did this reconnaissance?
I can't remember. It was probably when I was back in the platoon, I should think, at that time. Because we had inline pickets, you see, at that time. I mean, the company was, although this invasion threat was over, we still maintained internal inline picket, which would consist probably of a platoon or a company, depending on the situation. and they would be at so much hours' notice to go out.
And do you remember the scale of the possible threat, the reservoir being?
No, not really.
How many parachutists you thought might be?
It was just one of those vulnerable points which had been identified around the country as being vulnerable.
What was the idea that you should have a permanent guard there, or that you should have a...
No, we never sent a permanent guard. I think that... I don't think there was much chance that anything was going to happen during the winter months. I don't know. We never thought there would be, but you never know.
Springtime would be different, though, wouldn't it, once?
Well, exactly. we just made arrangements to get out there. I mean, if parachutists dropped in the vicinity, then obviously we would send a company out there straight away to secure it before that anybody could get there.
So the idea was that you would occupy the ground preemptively?
Yeah.
Not that you would have to attack it?
Yeah, both. I mean, if they got there first, then we would have to try and winkle them out.
Was it a well-defensible position?
No, it was very difficult, actually, because it consisted of a sort of a round, sort of small tower on a jetty. So it wasn't so far so much as protecting the actual place itself, but on the land, ensuring that people couldn't get at it.
So the Germans would have had a difficult...
They would have. I think they might have had a difficulty holding it, yes. Mm. They could have done a tremendous amount of damage if they got it.
Mm. I think then you moved from Leinster down to the south coast.
Yes, there was one other thing which is I've got here. So we had some. We used to go out shooting with the local people. I mean, I got a name here, Lord Corley or somebody used to have shooting parties. And then there was a chap called Sir James Croft who invited us to go and shoot. But when we got there, he didn't live in the main house because that was given over to refugees, his big mansion. He lived in a cottage. And when we got there, he said, oh, well, let's go to the main house and pick out a bottle of port each, which we did. And then we went back to his cottage and played cards all night, poker. So we never went shooting, but there was a lot of hospitality about at that time. And the other thing which I didn't mention was on the in a letter on the 30th of December, I find myself on a small arms course at Bisley. It was a 4-week course. Mostly confined to sort of sniping and camouflage, because as a battalion IO, you would be responsible for the snipers. And that was a very interesting course. I much enjoyed that. And I had a tremendous amount of snow about. Now, we spent a lot of time on the ranges with telescopic sights, and then we get lectures on map reading and going out and looking at the ground and seeing where suitable places for snipers or where the enemy might be and that sort of thing.
Some sniping courses seem to have concentrated particularly on things like field craft and stalking and have been conducted by gamekeepers in Scotland or other places.
Yeah.
Was there anything of that sort?
Yes, we used to go out. There was one chap that I remember who had been a hunter, mm-hmm. some sort. And he gave us lectures and took us out. And we used to do quite a bit of stalking and camouflage and appreciation of ground. And the thing I enjoyed most, of course, was using a sniper's rifle, which was great fun.
What sort of range would you be shooting at?
1,000 yards.
1,000 yards?
Yeah.
Could you hit an individual at that range?
With telescopic sights, yes. And then, of course, you have moving targets. There was the running deer that used to go across on wheels. You try and hit that before he got across the other side. But with telescopic sights, yes, it was a good 1,000 yards. I mean, we shot closer than that, but I mean, 1,000 yards was the ultimate.
Did you have an idea of a minimum range, a range beneath which you shouldn't?
What, use telescopic sights? No, I can't remember really. I imagine that if you was as a sniper lying up and a target presented itself 25 yards away, you wouldn't worry whether you got telescopic sights on or not, you just fire, I suppose. But normally you would expect targets to be 300, 400, 500 yards away.
What was the philosophy on target selection? Were you given an idea of who to shoot first?
I think it was just, if you got you obviously went for the officers if you could identify them. Mm. But it wasn't so easy in the last war to identify officers as it was in previous wars. Mm. But, I mean, if you got, you just had compelled to take on opportunity targets.
Did you have snipers in the battalion before you went on this course?
I don't think we did, no. I don't think we did. We certainly didn't have them in Germany, in the BEF. We certainly had them by the time we got to Normandy. I remember that very well because I still got some of the instructions that were given to them for going out. But I can't remember whether we had them on the establishment.
Sniping was somewhat controversial in that some people always thought that the amount of effort put into it was never repaid by results, whereas others felt that it was an excellent use of skilled manpower, that it would cause such disruption to the enemy that it was well worthwhile. Do you remember if there was any sort of discussion of the value of sniping in the battalion?
Can't remember at all. I mean, you didn't have many snipers, so there wasn't the question of using manpower, which could have been usefully used somewhere else. I can't remember how many snipers we actually had in the battalion when we got them, but it was it was under half a dozen.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that tended to happen was that people who'd been sent on the snipers course were often used much more for cover patrolling, reconnaissance patrolling in particular, rather than for actual sniping. Did that happen in the battalion, that the men who'd been trained to snipe wouldn't be sent out on patrol because of their field craft and their...
No, I don't remember that. I think snipers were snipers. Mm. But when we got out to Normandy and were doing the extra patrolling, of course, there was that anybody could go out on patrol. In fact, they did. Everybody had to go out on patrol. As a company commander, I used to have to take patrols out because we'd used all the men so much that I really hadn't had the face to ask them to go out again. So everybody had to be trained for patrolling on the reconnaissance patrols or standing patrols. Not very much of the fighting patrols. I mean, those are the three standard patrols I remember. I think the fighting patrols were more in the First World War, weren't they? Rushing across the trenches and grabbing prisoners. It didn't happen so much, I don't think. It may have happened in the desert, but I don't remember it happening in my experience.
And in Normandy, you'd be rather closely engaged. It would be difficult to mount that kind of operation.
Exactly, yes, with the bocage and... Yeah.
They did do it in Korea quite a lot.
Yes, it probably lent itself, and they probably needed it too. I mean, intelligence was probably difficult to get.
I mean, grabbing a prisoner was very important.
Yeah, get identifications of, especially when the Chinese came in, I think they probably wanted to find out what they were up to.
You mentioned there was camouflage too on, yes. on the course. What was the emphasis on in camouflage? Was it on concealment from enemy observers on the ground, or concealment from enemy aircraft, or from...
Well, it was concealment of the sniper himself.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Obviously, he had to hide up, and he'd be there a long time. Yeah. I know we're jumping ahead all the time on this, but in Normandy, we used to send our snipers out before first light, and they stayed out there all day and didn't come back until after it got dark again, so that they weren't seen.
What sort of things were done to camouflage them there? I mean, did they have special sniping suits?
No, I don't know. It was merely a question of making use of the... selecting a good spot. I mean, you obviously had to select a spot which was going to be useful in terms of killing power, but also gave adequate cover for the sniper.
How
they used to black their faces, I mean, that sort of thing, and hands and so forth.
What would be the characteristics of a good spot? What sort of spot would a sniper look for?
Well, first of all, he had to be hidden himself. He had to have a good field of fire. And it had to be in such a position that he could have a sight of the enemy if they moved or became visible. So usually you'd have to know the enemy positions before you put a sniper in position, because there wasn't any point in just sending a sniper out in the hope that the enemy might turn up. Once you knew where the enemy were, they may be 300 or 400 yards away in a wood or along a hedgerow or whatever, but you didn't see them, but you knew they were there. So that was the time to put a sniper up somewhere where he could, if any of them move, that was it. But we used to get sniper bullets singing over our heads now and again where we were from the enemy, and you got to show that some of them weren't very good shots, I suppose. The one bright spot, of course, that getting that autumn was the campaigns in North Africa and East Africa. Wavell's strategy, of course, but it was what was O'Connor in the desert and Cunningham in East Africa, wasn't it? And that gave us a big lift, because I mean, we pretty well wiped out most of the Italian capability. Certainly their army capability in Africa at that time. Took a huge number of prisoners, and I think they got as far as Benghazi and that Mataplan, of course, with the Navy, so that wiped out them. But I always remember reading Count Ciano, who may remember was Mussolini's son-in-law, kept a diary. And in it, this time, apparently Mussolini was so disgusted with his countrymen that he said he was going to resign from being an Italian. We all thought it was rather amusing at the time, but he didn't. He stayed on, I'm happy to say, because he probably helped us a lot.
Well, without him, they would not have entered the war, but with him, they inevitably lost it.
That's right, yes.
There was a battalion of the Essex Regiment out in the Sudan at that time, wasn't there?
Yes, that was the first battalion.
They took part in the campaign
yes.
of General Platt,
yes.
coming in from the north, going into Eritrea.
That's right.
But was there any contact with that sister battalion?
No, not at all. I know they ran into trouble there. I believe they had some problems. But no, we had no contact with the 1st Battalion at all, really.
So what was your main source of news? Was it newspapers or BBC?
You mean of the war itself?
Yes,
oh, yes,
news,
that's true.
There's news from Africa that was...
Yes, yes, so that came from papers, BBC. Mm-hmm. And probably we got a little note sent round, intelligence mm-hmm. note sent round to us by the War Office, which sent down so that we all knew what was going on.
What about the soldiers? Were the soldiers actively interested in this sort of war?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they were as delighted as anybody else, obviously, yeah.
Did you have a system in the battalion of disseminating this sort of news through lectures from officers to the soldiers?
Well, we used to have... well, yes, I would think there was. I don't remember it, but I'm pretty sure. I mean, it was important that information got down to the soldiers. At that time, we were beginning to realise that it was important that everybody was put, as they call it, in the picture. And, I'm sure we had, we used to talk to our troops about it, yeah.
Now, one of the senior officers who was keenest on this sort of thing, putting people in the picture, this is a phrase from Montgomery, isn't it? He was always talking about putting you in the picture.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. I mean, were you conscious of him being... keen on promoting that idea?
Not at this stage. About a year later, I certainly was, when we come to that.
Yes.
But at this stage, Montgomery, I mean, I know he commanded 3rd Division in the BEF, but he was an unknown in the army in those days, I think.
Did you see anything of senior officers at the time you were at Leominster?
We had our own... Colonel in Chief came down, or Colonel of the Regiment rather, came and had spent a day with us. And I remember writing home saying it was the best dinner I'd had in the mess for ever since we got back from Dunkirk. But he is the only one I think obviously the brigadier would come and see us, and probably the divisional commander would have come and seen us. As Artisan Kelso seems to be a name which rings a bell as the GOC of the division, 47th Division that was. And Ramsden, I know at that time, was our brigadier for the 25 Brigade. But I can't remember what other battalions were in the brigade at that time. Well, the next... letter I got, sent, on the 5th of February, was that I was saying that I was now battalion IO and promoted to full lieutenant. I was acting as assistant adjutant as well at that time.
As well as IO?
As well as IO. That was part of the duties, and I found it extremely useful. For the first time in my life, I sort of discovered how a battalion was run and organised and what the duties of a CO and an adjutant. And, of course, I came into contact with people like the quartermaster and the company commanders, signals, everybody. And for the first time, probably, I began to understand how a battalion worked and various parts and so forth worked together. And the personalities. But, of course, at that time, we lost a lot of our... personalities.
How did that happen?
Well, the older, I think you may remember when I was talking of the BEF days in France, most of our company commanders were well into their 40s. And when we got back home, after a bit they began to disappear, being posted away. And I know that 3 of them, Claude Wilson, who was our second in command, went, and he was given the duties of setting up an 8th battalion in the Essex Regiment, which he did. Another major called Henry Bousted left us, and he got the job of setting up the 9th Battalion of the Essex Regiment. And the other one was Tom Hearn. And he was one of the Irish ones who come from the Irish regiments which were disbanded. And he went off to form the 10th Battalion. So those three senior majors all went more or less at the same time. Now, they spent a year setting up their battalions, getting their recruits in, getting officers and so forth, and training it and making it gelling it into an efficient and well-trained battalion. But the 8th Battalion was then transformed into an armoured regiment. So it wasn't long before Claude had to go, because he couldn't obviously command an armoured regiment. The Henry Bousted's 9th Battalion was made medium regiment, RA, with 5.5s, I imagine, at that time, which they were with the equipment they had. So he didn't last long, because they had to have a gunner in charge. And the 10th Battalion became parachutists. And he obviously couldn't stay, because he was too old to jump in a parachute. And then there was a big turnover, of course, from all these three battalions, of bringing in experts from outside of the various arms. But all three of them finished up in 21st Army Group and went to Normandy at one stage or another.
And who replaced them in the battalion when they were posted out?
I just don't remember at that stage. It wasn't long before I had a company. At the age I just turned 22, we'll come to that in a minute, I got a company, a temporary captain. So I can't remember how they managed in the interim period, because we also lost our quartermaster, Silas Crane. He went. I always had the greatest admiration for quartermasters, because they fought their way up through the ranks, and they got to their positions as commissioned officers. And they were the salt of the earth, most of them. And old Silas was—he always reminded me of Mr. Pickwick. He didn't look at all like a quartermaster, but he was quite capable of, like all quartermasters. He wasn't a soft touch at all. I mean, he was a very nice old gentleman. Well, not old, but he was to me in those days. But he could quite happily stand in front of a whole pile of boots, and when he went in there and asked him for boots and said he hadn't got any, like all quartermasters. But dear old chap, he was one of nature's gentlemen, he really was. And he went off, and unfortunately we heard about 2 years later he died in the UK, so we didn't know why. It was something natural, I think. And our regiment... Sorry.
I'm going to ask you, what is a quartermaster supposed to look like?
Well, I don't know. I think most of them looked a bit sort of more rugged than he did. After all, they'd spent a lot of time in the ranks. and they were, in those days, I mean, they'd been in the army for over 20 years, all of them. And they'd served in places all over the empire. So they began to look, you know, they looked seasoned. But Silas didn't. I mean, I remember seeing him once in his going into his office one day, and when he was changing, and he was standing there, and like all good quartermaster, in pairs of pants, woolen long, and a vest, and he looked just like Mr. Pickwick. He was bald, and he got glasses on. And I thought, you know, there's Mr. Pickwick. But we lost him. We lost the RSM, RSM Sutton, who, as I think I mentioned before, was an excellent RSM. He was everything you would expect an RSM to look like. I don't know whether I mentioned his pictures in the National Army Museum. Yes, I did.
Do you remember what happened to him?
Yes, he went to the depot, which then became an infantry training centre, ITC, and expanded, of course, considerably during the war. And he went there as RSM. And then finally, when he retired, he finished up in the Tower as Chief Warder, or whatever they call them. And then his place was taken by Gulliver, RSM Gulliver. He wasn't the same build, but he was a very energetic little chap who people respected, because he was on the ball the whole time.